The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. It wasn't going to be easy. I don't know what Jesus thought this was going to be like. While he was toweling off from his baptism, he had to be feeling pretty good, though, wouldn't you think? Baptism for anyone is a sacred, special moment, and none of us have gotten the kind of reception that he did. The heavens opened up. The Holy Spirit descended on him like a dove. A voice from heaven rang out, "You are my beloved Son. With you I am well pleased." Rarely does Trinitarian glory shine like it did Jesus' baptism. The voice of the Father, the manifestation of the Spirit, the Son, beloved, affirmed, commissioned to his redemptive ministry. Surely he was feeling pretty good about these things. This is a good start. But if Jesus had any idea at all in his mind that his incarnate life would be an easy road to cosmic glory, it was dispelled very quickly in the wilderness, where the Spirit immediately sent him for a different kind of baptism. If he hadn't learned it before, he learned it now. Created bodies get hungry. Not just "I love a piece of chocolate" hungry, or "it's been a few hours since my last meal" hungry. Really hungry. It's the way all of life is created. Cycles of hunger, eating, satisfaction, renewed strength, and then hunger again. Our lives are ordered by our need for food. We share this characteristic with plants, fish, all animals, and the 12 million children in our country who don't know where their next meal is coming from. Jesus spent a long time without eating. Luke says it was 40 days, which is a long time. It's something like not opening your refrigerator again until Easter Sunday, April 21st. Most of us are just happy to make it to lunch without our stomachs awkwardly growling loudly during a moment of silence. Jesus was hungry, just like you would be. His body was in pain, just like yours would be. He suffered, just like you would suffer. He was fully God. Yes, let's never forget that. But he was also fully human. This story makes no sense if we allow his divine nature to invalidate the experience of being human, when in fact it complicates it even further, because he could do something about it. He was fully human, in the wilderness, all alone, and he was hungry. Why? I wonder if he asked that question. Why was he out there? There's no ancient wisdom I'm aware of that says a Messiah must be ordained by 40 days in the wilderness not eating anything. There's no law that said he couldn't eat something. There's more instruction to you about not drinking a soda during Lent than there was for Jesus fasting for 40 days. So why? The Spirit led him there. The Spirit led him to the wilderness. One of the other Gospels says the Spirit drove him out there, or like pushed him out there. Whatever else this is not just his choice. It seems to have something to do with learning what it means to be human, right as he's about to begin his public ministry to and with other humans. Humans get hungry. They suffer pain. Jesus is learning solidarity with human need. It looks a lot, too, like he's living in one human life, the story of Israel, the nation whose life was defined by their journey in the wilderness and whose faith was refined by their need to trust God in all things, even their hunger. Like they journeyed in the wilderness for 40 years, he's there for 40 days. Like they were hungry and thought they would die, so he now hungers and wonders the same about himself. And then one day, it's amazing, actually it hadn't happened until then, one day Jesus looks down at a stone at his feet. One of those rounded stones that are strewn across the landscapes of barren places all around the world. He looks down at the stone and the idea crosses his mind. That stone looks like it would make an amazing loaf of bread. It has weight in his hands. His fingers trace the texture of the stone's surface like it's a flaky crust. The idea came from somewhere. Luke says it came from the devil. Now, that's important to remember, that the temptation that was about to come was coming from the father of lies, the deceiver who in this moment with Jesus is returning to strategies that had worked in the beginning with the first Adam, who was not hungry at all and had everything he could have ever wanted to eat right there in the fruitful garden. Adam, who heard the words of temptation, did God really say not to eat the fruit of that tree? Did God really say that? Those words have always worked with human creatures. Jesus was tempted to turn a stone into bread to eat. The mental image of a red, pointy-tailed, pitchfork-carrying devil standing next to Jesus having a discussion with him gets in the way of hearing this story for its power. And so I hope you'll push that image out of your mind if you have it. You have to picture a man alone, all alone. You have to picture him hungry, so very hungry. And you have to hear the words in his ear, in his mind, as if they were his own thought. If we make the devil a cartoonish and obvious tempter, it's not a temptation. If Jesus can swat the thought away like batting practice because he's God and the devil is the devil, it's not really much of what we would call a temptation. But if the temptation is subtle, if the idea is whispered, if it just comes and sits next to you, makes friends with you, and if the thing is possible, and if it's desired, well, we know what temptation is like. Temptations have a persuasive quality to them in which something bad seems like something good. A temptation is not a temptation unless it's within your power to enact it. Otherwise, it's just an idea. But if you can solve a problem you think you have, or cease some suffering that you or someone else is experiencing, or take some action, and it's in your power to do it, well, now you're working with something here. Jesus was tempted. He could command the stone to become bread, and presumably it would. Later he made water blush into wine, and a few loaves multiply to feed thousands. He, I think, could do this thing. We must see the utter force of the temptation. This was something Jesus could do. This was something Jesus in some way must have wanted to do. This would solve a problem. It would relieve his suffering. And besides, what actual harm would be done? What, the world can't do less with one rock? Somehow that would disrupt the natural order of things, like a butterfly effect? I can't really figure out how Jesus would have sinned simply by eating a loaf of Wonder Bread in the wilderness. But I don't think that it's simply a matter of being tempted to sin. There's no law against eating bread or turning to stone into bread if you're one of those people who's able to do such a thing. This was not a temptation to commit a sin as if it's an individual sin, like a temptation to do something clearly and obviously wrong, like with Adam and Eve, who were tempted to go against exactly what God had told them. This was even more sinister. This was even more devious. It's a temptation to shortcut his identity. If he turns that stone into bread to cease the sufferings of hunger he was experiencing, what else will he be willing to do to avoid suffering? All three of the temptations point in the same direction. One is about bread and solving a problem that his human body has presented. One is about empires and solving the problem that the political powers would present. One is about the temple and solving the problem of the religious institution. He didn't have a problem yet with all those, but he would in no time at all. These three entities would converge to bring about his death. His body suffering on a Roman cross with the collusion of the temple priests and leaders. In the end, the church and state would conspire to hang his body on a cross until it died. This was to be the fate of the Word become flesh to dwell among us. But it didn't have to be. He had the power to stop it, to save himself from this pain. The temptations were not, what will you do in the wilderness? The temptations were, what will you do with your life? The courage and faith that he had later at Gethsemane when he prayed, take this cup from me, but not my will, but yours be done. The courage and faith in him then was born in him in the wild when he refused to shortcut his humanity by his divinity, and turned away from the temptation to control creation, people, and institutions around him for his own preservation. The faith he had to submit to God in all things was born right here. The real temptation wasn't just whether he would eat some bread instead of fasting, but was under what conditions he would use his power to escape from suffering. What would he give to combat and control kingdoms and empires who were serving the force of darkness? What would he do to overcome corrupt, self-serving religion? The answer is, it seems, nothing but die for them. He would not be the kind of Messiah who rides in to take charge and bend the world to his purposes. He'd be a different kind. Knew himself to be called to be a different kind of Messiah, the prophet of an in-breaking, upside-down, inside-out kingdom, herald of a God whose power looks like weakness to the human eye and whose wisdom sounds like foolishness to the human ear. The path that led to Gethsemane was set in the wilderness, and from it, he never wavered. We began our Lenten journey by marking one another's head with the cross in ash under gray cloths. We will end this journey by washing one another's feet as the gray gives way to black. From head to toe, this journey with Christ calls for our whole selves, our hungers, our politics, our religion, our needs, our wants, our fears, that which fulfills us and that which threatens us. We're all in on this journey. Lent is a bodily season. The great Lenten disciplines are about fasting, confession, and almsgiving. It's not just a heart season. It's not just a head season. It's about our bodies. Whatever Lenten disciplines we embrace, our bodies are involved. Not as a sacrifice to God in hope of salvation. That sacrifice has already been paid. We don't earn our salvation. But our bodies are involved in participation in the work of the Spirit in us. It's in Lent, most of all, that we remember our faith isn't just mental assent and isn't just emotive expression. It's about our bodies, asking our stomachs to hurt a little bit from fasting, our knees to be a little sore from being bent in prayer, our hands a little tender from service, our feet a little tired from going where they are led. Lent is an embrace of a little pain to remember that we too are human, all in created glory and all in need of grace. If we endure bodily discipline past the point of comfort, even just a little, we do so in solidarity with those who, beyond their choice and without the power to change things, suffer already, enduring broken bodies, broken lives, and broken hearts, and broken relationships. We do so in solidarity with all creation, groaning as if in childbirth for its redemption. This is holy work. The prayer of our bodies, joining the cries of all creation. Jesus would not abandon us even through his terrible suffering. He would not forsake the path. He would not call down 10,000 angels to rescue him. He would not call down manna in the wilderness to feed him. He would not abandon his body. He would not call a heavenly army to fight his battles or perform miracles to convince skeptical religious leaders of the righteousness of his mission. He simply was faithful in whatever circumstances, at whatever cost, to the calling to bring salvation to a hurting and broken world by taking on its hurt, its brokenness, its sin, and its death. For us, the Lenten journey with Jesus has begun. It's not going to be easy, and it shouldn't be. But Christ has gone before us and goes with us now still. Amen.